From 89.7 WUWM Milwaukee Public Radio, this is Lake Effect Weekend. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Tyke. Today on the show, an unlikely project to plant commercial rice in southeastern Wisconsin.
Then, with Bastille Days underway here in Milwaukee, we'll find out why Wisconsin is more French than you might imagine.
The Frenchman first wrote the word Wisconsin, which was an Indian word that hadn't been written, and spelt it O-U-I-S-C-O-N-S-I-N. And the French spelling stayed with Wisconsin for about 100 years until more English speakers came and put a W there.
And the place of French food in our culinary landscape of beer and brats.
I thought if you could do traditional artisan baking using good ingredients, learn classic techniques to make sure that the structure was right, the texture was right, the flavor profiles were right, I thought that perhaps there would be a market for.
Plus, we'll have the latest edition of our storytelling series, Ex-Fabula. Lake Effect Weekend is next. News is first. Good afternoon. This is Lake Effect Weekend on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Tyke. Rice is one of the world's staple foods and one of the most widely eaten, especially in Asia. The UN reports that rice is the agricultural commodity with the third highest worldwide production. But for all of Wisconsin's agricultural prowess, rice has not been a crop produced commercially here, at least not until now.
As part of our full plate series on agriculture, Lake Effect's Susan Benz takes us to an acre plot in rural Ozaukee County, where a Marquette University scientist by the name of Michael Schlappi, along with several students and Hmong immigrant farmers from Laos, are taking the next step in Wisconsin's rice production.
Marquette student Kristen Stannis appears both bewildered and amazed as she looks at the evolving rice paddy on what was formerly a cornfield outside the city of Mequon. A tractor moves back and forth through the field, leveling the land, while a cluster of women, wide hats protecting their faces from an intense midday sun, deftly plunk clusters of seedlings into the mud.
I started in, I think, 2 weeks ago.
Great.
And we've just been planting today, just going through the motions of planting, and I guess I'm more learning about rice farming, what it takes, what we're putting in, all the efforts that we're doing. And
Stannis is a biomedical sciences student interested in business who was invited to come aboard as a project intern.
As the process moves forward, I would say just evaluating just all of our expenses, all of our cash flows, and developing it into a business model for what we're doing here.
Stannis's boss, scientist Michael Schlappi, says he was able to bring on interns, pay them, and buy some basic equipment thanks to an innovation grant from the university. Schlappi experimented with rice varieties from around the globe for 5 years, testing how they stood up to Wisconsin weather in miniature paddies he built on his lab rooftop on campus. He settled on a short grain variety from Russia. 2 years ago, he took the experiment to a farm field outside Port Washington. A story we produced on the experiment made its way as far as Vermont, where it reached the ears of a rice farmer named Eric Andrus, who today is on a tractor in this field, breaking up soil as Schlappi watches.
He sold me this machine.
The 3-horsepower mechanical transplanter manufactured in China, Schlappi is standing next to.
So we have a relationship. He's kind of my consultant. But around the same time as I got interested in this, he got interested through a workshop that he learned from a Japanese farmer in Vermont. He's actually doing it commercially now in Vermont. But he heard me 2 years ago. That's how he made the contact.
Wow.
And I think this would not be at this stage, because 2 years ago he asked me, what's next? Because he looked at the small paddies at the Fondy farm in Port Washington, remember? And we were, they were small, right? It was just more like, see if this can work in Wisconsin. But this is actually production size. So this is commercial production. This is intended for commercial production. And I could only do it with the grant from Marquette to involve the undergrads, like my interns here just talked to. I have several biology interns as well who work on this. You know, and I try to pay them well so they're happy and hopefully stay with me for the duration of this grant.
Vermonter Eric Andrus climbs off the tractor for a sec. He grows rice on 5.3 acres back at home,
which is small by most any standard, but
We're hoping for better than 10,000 pounds of rice sales this year. So that goes a long way towards constructing my annual income. Eventually, I'd like to expand to maybe about 10 or 15 acres, but probably not beyond that.
Like Schlappi, Andres hopes to inspire others because he says there's no way he can personally scratch the surface of the demand for high-quality rice.
Michael and I have been corresponding for a while, so we've been sort of working up to this moment. And I also have a personal connection to Wisconsin because I attended high school and graduated from Whitefish Bay.
Did you?
So yeah. It's a sort of my old haunts here. Yeah. And now I'm coming back here to plant rice. So it's like, my goal is to plant rice coast to coast. It's like so funny.
Andres has experience in working with farmers who know far more about rice growing than he.
In Vermont, we have a Nepali refugee community, and those people are also very passionate about rice. Yeah. So I have had those folk doing work sometimes on my farm. I've attended rice events where they also attend. So there's a little bit of cross-pollination all around, and they're from Southeast Asia, not Central Asia, but the atmosphere is very similar. My hope is that we can all kind of develop this together with some ideas imported from overseas, some developed locally, and some brought in from, you know, the cultures that these people have brought with them.
Here in Wisconsin, Michael Schlappi says fruitful partnerships have helped him get this far. When he first ventured out to Port Washington, he used a bit of land managed by Fondi Market, a long-standing enterprise in the heart of Milwaukee. Fondi Executive Director Jennifer Casey has formed a relationship with Mequon Nature Preserve, where Fondi is farming space in the preserve's northwest corner.
20 acres here, and we would love to expand. We could not meet the demand for the amount that we had. 33 farmers that wanted to farm on site with us this year, just word of mouth.
So remind me what the arrangement is.
We rent the land. Fondi Food Center rents the land from Mequon Nature Preserve. Yep, and at Port Washington. Mm-hmm. We, in turn, rent out the actual land, parcels of land. Maybe it's a half acre or an acre to a farm family. And they also, in addition to paying for rent for the land, have access to our tractors. We do all of the tilling in the spring and then again in the fall. Our farm director, Stephen, is probably the most important resource that they have access to. And so he's on site a couple of days a week to help troubleshoot, make sure that the equipment is working correctly or if any training needs to happen. So we offer a suite of resources. Of course, we're looking at getting irrigation up and running for the entire farm this year.
The Mequon site is a mere 13 miles from the market, far closer and more convenient for Fondi farmers. Casey says she's on the lookout for more affordable land small farmers can count on one year to the next. She says the Fondi Farm's original purpose was to ensure farmers at the market had access to quality land on which to grow. She sees the rice project fitting into their mission.
I've talked to several of the farmers here today who have not planted rice or worked in a rice field for 20 years. And everyone that I've talked to is enjoying themselves, including these young men. You should definitely talk to them, Susan. I mean, I think that they could better tell you in your own words, but of course many of these ladies were growing rice in Laos before they had to become refugees and before they came to this country, before they fled to this country. And we had an outpouring of interest at the rice trial plot at the Port Washington farm. Pi, in the red there, she's experimenting with her own test plot with rice that she brought back from her sister who grows down south. But the cultural significance, I mean, rice is found in not just cuisine, but art and folk stories of the Hmong culture, the Hmong people. It's an important food. Obviously, there's the tying the community together because harvesting and planting is a communal process.
Pai and her fellow farmers are knee-deep in mud and too busy planting to pay me any attention. Chu Sang Vang and his two brothers stand at the sidelines, passing the women flats of seedlings or smoothing the soggy earth when directed to do so. Vang's parents are farmers, but they're not here today.
So what do you think about
this process?
This process right here, it's kind of slow, but I can see how they started when they did it in Laos and how my parents grew up doing this. So
have kind of a special feeling, or does it just feel totally foreign because it's something you didn't do?
Yeah. Because I come here like thinking like we're going to use a machine and all of that, but then we're going to do it this one by hand. So I get to know how they felt when they were doing it by hand back in Laos.
So have you tried it yourself?
Yes, I've tried. It's kind of...
How's it feel?
Slimy. Really slimy. I'm not really good at it, but I'm slowly learning.
Vang is studying film and video production, but says when he can, he helps his parents, who sell at Fondi. He finds this rice planting experience, slimy or not, moving.
It is hard, but it's a little bit rewarding too. You have to get to see them because, like I said, my parents own a lot over there, so I usually help them. So I can probably come down here and see how the rice are doing.
Michael Schlappi looks on and smiles as Vang and his brothers assist the women. They're beginning to take ownership of their section of paddy.
The section they're standing in right now, it's really wet, and they kept complaining that it's not leveled, the field is not leveled enough. So, but now I see them hacking, you know, they use a hack to... or a hoe to take pieces from the berm and push it into the section that's not flat enough. So they're taking matters in their own hand to make flatness out. I think they want to win the context in terms of yield, which they might, you know.
That wasn't Schlappi's original position. He thought machine planted would conquer. Altogether, 250,000 seedlings were nested into the soggy earth. And Schlappi says if all goes well, it could yield a couple thousand pounds of rice. We'll let you know how that turns out. For Lake Effect, I'm Susan Bentz.
You can hear all of our full plate segments at WUWM.com. Milwaukee celebrates Bastille Days all weekend, and up next we'll learn about our state's French history. Lake Effect Weekend continues in a moment on Milwaukee Public Radio. Lake Effect Weekend continues. I'm Bonnie North. And I'm Mitch Tyke. Friday was Bastille Day, the French Independence Day, and although we tend to think of Milwaukee as having more German and Slavic roots, the French maintained an important presence here even before Wisconsin officially became a state. Exploring the Midwest in the 1600s, the French were the first people to literally put Wisconsin on the map.
From Solomon Junot to Jean Nicolet, there are many French names we recognize in Milwaukee, but Anne LaPlay and Mary Emery of the Alliance Française de Milwaukee say they want Wisconsinites to understand the French history and culture that are present beyond this weekend's Bastille Day celebration.
Lake Effect's Audrey Nowakowski first spoke with them last year, and LaPlay explained that the French influence in Wisconsin goes way back.
The first map makers came in the 1600s to make maps of Wisconsin, and it was the first time that Wisconsin was actually put on paper. And in fact, the Frenchmen first wrote the word Wisconsin, which was an Indian word that hadn't been written, and spelt it O-U-I-S-C-O-N-S-I-N. And the French spelling stayed with Wisconsin for about 100 years until more English speakers came and put a W there. And then in 1825, Solomon Junot, who was a French-Canadian, settled in what is now Milwaukee and set up a trading post on the corner of Water Street and Wisconsin Avenue and declared the area between Milwaukee River and Lake Michigan Juneau Town, which eventually became Milwaukee.
And he was our first mayor as well.
Yes, mayor. Yes. Yeah.
Now, you mentioned this trading post. Were there a lot of fur traders even in northern Wisconsin to begin with when they first came to the state? What was bringing them to the Midwest?
The fur.
Yeah. Right, and yeah. Green Bay. Solomon Junot first went to Green Bay, but Jacques Viaud, his father-in-law, was the first man who came here, and he was a fur trader.
You mentioned the Juneau town that started, but was that the first truly large immigrant base compared to the other communities that were already established in Milwaukee?
I don't think there's ever been a big French immigrant base. It just happens that the French wrote the first map, so a lot of words were written in French. So either they translated the Indian words into French or they named cities after themselves. So there's that French heritage through names of cities. But there has never been a French immigrant base like you have the Germans or the Irish or the Italians.
And the French were closely related with the Indians in working with them and establishing, and as you mentioned, they're translating this. So does their heritage cross over with Indian heritage here in the state as well? Were those communities intertwined?
Yes. In fact, there's a history of métissage, of actual marriages and children who were both French and Indian. Mostly the French fur traders married Indian women. I don't think it went the other way.
Yeah.
Right. So who were some of the most notable Frenchmen who made a lasting impact on Milwaukee's history? You mentioned Solomon Juneau. What are some other notables, or even in Wisconsin overall?
Jacques Marquette, Louis Joliet, Jacques Viau,
Jean-Nicolet.
Yeah. So they were sort of the founding fathers of Wisconsin.
And what was their role long term? We recognize we have Marquette University, Nicolet High School, some of the things we see as names most notably today. But what did they do for Wisconsin and Milwaukee?
I think they put it on the map, as Anne said. They came in their canoes and amazingly made these maps and sent them back to Europe. I'm not sure how that worked, but it happened.
Yeah, and they were also trailblazers, so they brought other people in and made little settlements like this little trading post, starting little businesses in Wisconsin.
Now, and you're with the organization, help me with my pronunciation here.
Alliance Française de Milwaukee.
There we go. Beautiful. And this was founded in 1918. So how did this come about? What was it when it was founded and what has it turned into today? Because as you mentioned, there wasn't a strong immigrant base, particularly in any one place, but yet this organization came about.
So the founder of our organization is Amélie Séraphin, who founded the Alliance Française de Milwaukee in 1918. We're heading into our 100th anniversary in Milwaukee. And she was a French professor at Milwaukee Downer College, which was located in the brownstone buildings of UWM campus and later became Lawrence University in Appleton. And 1918 is significant because it's the end of the First World War. So a lot of the efforts early on in our organization was supporting France and the French people in the aftermath of a devastating world war. Also, there were a lot of Milwaukee, especially Milwaukee women, who were interested in learning and speaking French.
So we brought a copy of a poster from 1918, a benefit to help the fatherless children of France. And this was an effort all over the United States. But we had one of the most active chapters to help the fatherless children of France, the orphans of France. So that was the beginning of our Alliance Française, which is a chapter of a worldwide organization based in Paris. There are chapters all over the world and about 115 chapters in the United States.
And Milwaukee is one of the oldest. The other place where there are a lot of French companies are the small cheese makers. So that similarity between France, which is, you know, obviously very big on cheese, and Wisconsin, which is also big on cheese. So there's a lot of crossing between those two.
Now, and Mary, you've been a long-time member or a board member, volunteer. You've been involved with this organization.
Yes.
And you mentioned that you were part of and went to the original Bastille Day. So for you being a part of this organization and in various roles over the years, what can you remember from that first Bastille Day and looking forward to this one coming up?
Sure. It was the brainchild of François Niveau, who happened to be the managing director of the Pfister Hotel. And he was a dynamic young man. And he said, we should have a Bastille Day celebration. And one of the first things I remember is one of the events he had. They were dressed as soldiers in Napoleonic costumes, and they cut off the tops of champagne bottles to serve the champagne with their swords. They sliced off the tops of the champagne bottles, and that was just amazing to all of us. And it originally was down near the Pfister Hotel on Jefferson Street, and then eventually eased its way up into Cathedral Square, and it has become the big festival that it is now. And I guess the changes I've seen in our Alliance Française in the 80s, we had members Sharon and Dmitry Andonov who had the idea that we should start selling beignets, making beignets, the deep-fried donuts, at the festival. So now that's become a huge thing, and we're proud of our beignets, and it helps support our organization, really, for the whole year.
Just from beignets?
Just from beignets. But from the first, we've tried our best to add the French element. We've had French lessons, and we'll be giving French mini lessons 3 or 4 times a day down at Cathedral Square. And we're really proud to be involved.
That's great. Most residents in Milwaukee obviously know of Bastille Days that comes around every summer. But perhaps in greater Milwaukee and even Wisconsin, people don't know the significance of French heritage here. So how do you think this can be changed? And what's the main thing you want people to know about the French community here in Wisconsin and its place in history?
Well, I think it's important to see a modern France, not just something, you know, set in the 40s or 50s or the 1700s. The French culture is very dynamic, and it's been even more dynamic because of its colonies. So if you listen to music, there's a little bit of Haitian influence, a little bit of North African influence. It can have a little Quebec influence. So just that sort of worldwide influence in music, in literature. You know, they have in the Académie Française, so the sort of the National Academy of Literature, a Haitian guy, a Russian guy who writes in French. You have Chinese people who write in French. So, you know, the fact that that France is not really stuck in a 20th century mode, but it's a really very much of a 21st century culture.
Mm-hmm. We're proud to have a lot of young families move to Milwaukee for different business reasons. And when we have family events like the Fête des Rois in January, we have lots of young families that come from France to be in Milwaukee.
Yeah,
so we're very proud of that.
And they were all together yesterday for the European Cup. It was not a happy ending for the French, but there was definitely a lot of French groups getting together in some of the bars on the east side of Milwaukee.
Do you notice more French people and families coming and settling here? Or is it more so a place that's become a destination to visit?
There are people settling, not necessarily. The French families tend to stay for a couple of years and not eternally. Mm-hmm. They're often with GE Medical, Johnson Controls, some of these bigger companies with a short-term contract. There are more and more French-speaking families from Africa. And that tends to be growing the French-speaking immigrant base. The Congo, Senegal, other West African countries, Haitians, we're seeing more and more Haitians. The people from Quebec, they're kind of more spread out. There's a small community in the Kenosha area, I believe. But we're not seeing a particularly big group of French settling, but more here for a few years and then going back, and there's sort of a turning around.
And from their feedback, what do they think of Milwaukee and their community that they're building here?
They fall in love with it. Often they come a little bit nervous about what they're going to find in Milwaukee, and when they actually settle, they love everything that Milwaukee and Wisconsin has to offer, all the things they can do with the lake, traveling around Wisconsin, the proximity to Chicago, just the ease of life here, you know, especially for Parisians who are used to living in a small apartment in a very bustling town when you have a couple kids. Life in Milwaukee is just heaven. So,
and we had one group who wrote a book called Milwaukee Accueil, which means welcome, Milwaukee welcome, and they made a directory of, for example, physicians who speak French, where to get French cheeses in Milwaukee, a whole directory that actually needs updating. But
yeah, and now this younger group of French families have created a Facebook page, and they are extremely active in getting together and doing things together.
Really solidifying a place and making it available for more to come, I'm sure. All right. Well, Anne and Mary, thank you so much for coming in and teaching us a little bit about French history here in Milwaukee and Wisconsin. It's fascinating.
Thank you.
Thank you.
It's a pleasure.
Anne LaPlay and Mary Emery of the Alliance Française de Milwaukee first spoke with Audrey Nowakowski last year. The annual Bastille Day celebrations continues all weekend at Cathedral Square in downtown Milwaukee. You'll find a link to the full schedule at WUWM.com.
Coming up next, from French history to French food, we visit with the owner of North Shore Boulangerie when Lake Effect Weekend continues on Milwaukee Public Radio. Welcome back to Lake Effect Weekend. I'm Mitch Teich.
And I'm Bonnie North. Before the break, we heard about the historical influence the French had on Wisconsin in general and on Milwaukee in particular. And while we are certainly known for hearty German fare like brats and beer, the French also had and have a culinary influence here.
A newer player on the French food scene here is the North Shore Boulangerie in Shorewood. Their storefront has been open since 2014, but this is the first year they're participating in Bastille Days. Lake Effect's Audrey Nowakowski met up with North Shore's owner Gene Webb at Cathedral Square Park to find out what it was about French cuisine that caught his fancy.
Before opening the store in Shorewood, I saw that there had been a trend in baking that had gone on for the last 20 years or so, where factory baking or big production baking, mechanical baking, had kind of permeated the market. And whenever that sort of thing happens, often it goes a little too far. It takes over too much of the market, and it drives out a lot of the artisan bakers. And I thought it had kind of the pendulum had swung enough and food had become enough of a topic for people that you could bring artisan baking in and that there would be a market for it.
And you've also studied the fundamentals of French cuisine, both in baking and in savory culinary dishes, having been to France and studied that. What impacted you the most in that experience that you wanted to bring over and translate to what you do at North Shore Boulangerie?
That the ingredients you start with are as important as what you do with them. It's very hard to start with poor quality industrial ingredients and come up with anything that is a real food product, a traditional food product. And I think the trend in, and again, kind of harking back to this kind of industrial baking, and most of the food industry, big industry food, is to make the product look right, to get you to buy it. But once you get it, the flavors aren't right, the textures aren't right, it lasts for 2 weeks on the counter, there's something not right going on there. So I thought if you could do traditional artisan baking using good ingredients, learn classic techniques, and to make sure that the structure is right, the texture is right, the flavor profiles were right, which is a big thing in French baking and French cuisine in general, to make sure that there's the flavors are layered in, there's a flavor profile, that it's not just one predominant flavor coming on. I thought that perhaps that would be something that there would be a market for.
Do you think that's also a way of changing our look at eating food in general? How you say, you know, the French value good ingredients, quality, you enjoy it as it's made fresh, whereas here, as you said, they're meant to have longer shelf life. It's more of a convenience. It's not necessarily an experience of baking.
Yeah, I think hopefully if you can present the food correctly and if you can do it well, I mean, mm-hmm. It has to be done well, that it's less about quantity and it's more about quality. And I think that's a big thing. There's many themes that run through French culinary tradition, but that's another one, that it's the quality, not the quantity, that a few bites of something very, very good can be so much more satisfying than a whole bag of something that you can't understand the ingredient list, but you get a whole lot of it and you don't pay much for it. So I think it's a great time in American cuisine because the people are thinking about the ingredients, they're thinking about what they're eating. All the artisan brewers, the artisan bakers, the artisan cheese makers, people are thinking about these things, and it's a wonderful time for us. I think, like I said, you know, the ebb and flow, kind of the swing that industrial food production, I think, overstepped, right? And they were pushing the quality down to
increase the profit margin. It supports huge executive and corporate structures above all those inexpensive products. So you have to produce that much food at that price point. The ingredient list is it's tough. You have to push pretty hard on your ingredient list to sustain that sort of setup.
Now, even though this isn't your storefront, you know, I imagine you're translating some of the things you do offer at your storefront, such as, you know, pastries and coffee in the morning and simple, well-made, classic French dishes outside of that. But have you added anything else specifically for Bastille Days?
Oh, absolutely. It's something I wanted to do from the beginning, but as you, or maybe other people haven't discovered this, I discovered it. When you open your first shop, there's so much to do, and you hope you can get to all your dreams. But reality soon encroaches, and there's things you can do and things that you have to wait on. And one of the things that I had always wanted to bring to the community was the Alsatian tradition of tart flambé, wood-fired savory tarts. It looks a little bit like a pizza, has a different sauce. The classic is a fromage blanc white cheese sauce with onions and bacon. So we're having a lot of fun with that. This morning, firing up the ovens for the first time. They were delivered yesterday. We seasoned them in last night and got everything running this morning. So we're having a lot of fun. The first two or three that came out of the oven weren't exactly what we wanted, but I think we're getting it now.
And also something that's unique, and from what I understand, you are a first distributor of, is coffee from Café Richard. And so explain to me what makes this coffee special, and is it the standard in France?
We are so incredibly honored to partner with Café Richard. We will be the first store in Wisconsin to have it. Café Richard, Maison Richard, is the premier coffee roaster in Paris. And over three-quarters of all the coffee shops around Paris and now in all the provinces serves Café Richard. And the coffee is... Whereas American coffees have gone a little bit lighter in flavor and getting into kind of the fruity profiles of coffee, what I had wanted from the very beginning for my shop was that classic full-bodied European coffee. And we managed to do it. We put together custom recipes to get there. But about 6 months ago, I was at a fundraising event for culinary scholarships, and I had been asked, my pastry chef and I had been asked to bring pastries, and Café Richard flew in all this coffee from Paris, and they were right next to us. I clearly liked what I had from there, and they enjoyed seeing what we had. They came to Milwaukee, came to the shop up in Shorewood. They liked what they saw there, and they said they'd like to partner with us. So this is sort of our first jump off with Café Richard. And so it's a wonderful full-bodied flavor. It's just very classic coffee. We're serving cappuccino, espresso, and a very full-bodied drip. So, I'm very pleased about that. I was doing a happy dance the day that all came together.
Well, and it's especially a great thing to have another standout coffee in Milwaukee, where it's known for plenty of other coffee roasters, but to bring something different to the table.
Yeah, I thought that might... There are a lot of... There's a lot of local coffee on the market. Of course, coffee doesn't grow here, so we don't have locally grown coffee, but a lot of roasters. But, I thought it would... It's, again, when you see the market go wholly in another direction and maybe get a little saturated, I think that's the time to see if there's room for that other part of the market. And that's, again, the same theme with bringing in Café Richard.
Another thing you do at North Shore Boulangerie is your Levant-style bread. So can you explain to me what that process is and what makes your breads unique and more flavorful?
So there is, in Europe, and certainly in France and in the northern part of the country around Alsace, where the chefs that taught me were from, Levant baking is the standard. And it's sort of, you can think of Levant, it's not wholly accurate, but a way to think about it, it's the precursor to American sourdough, except you use wild French yeast. My culture comes from Bordeaux, a wild yeast culture to leaven the bread. And that adds, even though you're not making sour bread dough per se, because you don't use as much as you would for a sourdough loaf, and the culture doesn't quite go to that end of the growth curve to get you a sour culture, it adds a really great flavor profile. And I mentioned that earlier about in other parts of French cuisine, flavor profiles. One of the challenges for a bread bakery is you only have usually four ingredients. And with those four ingredients, you have to come up with various flavor profiles. And Lavande is a great way to do it. Like I said, it's a wild yeast culture. We have it grown. I had to buy a special fermenter in my shop that grows the Lavande. And you grow it up, and it's just a lovely, lovely way to bake. I've compared recipes with and without Lavande in the same oven, same day, same deck. And the complexity and just the flavor is so much better with the exact same recipe with Lavande versus without Lavande. You actually get this really flavorful bread, whereas if you just use quick rise yeast, you get the structure of bread, but not the flavor.
Bastille Days does its part to bring some of France to Milwaukee, but you know, you're here year-round with your storefront, and this is your first year here at Bastille Days. So I'm wondering, do you have any hopes for people to at least be more perceptive, more open to French cuisine in Milwaukee, or have you already seen that change for the better? What do you hope that your presence here will translate over to outside of Bastille Days?
I think in general, overall, Milwaukee's a very, there's a wonderful food culture in Milwaukee, always has been. When the Chicago newspapers are talking about how you should go up to Milwaukee to eat, because for a mid-sized American city, we have an incredible cuisine culture, the variety and the quality of food. We're an agricultural state, after all. But it's in general, Milwaukee has always had a really great food scene. Food has always been part of our tradition and heritage. I think with coming to Bastille Days, what we're hoping to do is let people know that there are additional outlets for French cuisine in Milwaukee. We love being in Shorewood. Over the last year, we've started to distribute our bread all around the city with Sendix, which we're very proud to partner with them as well. But it's letting people know that we're up on the North Shore, that Shorewood is a great place to come, that it has a wonderful restaurant, both daytime and evening restaurants, and they should come up and give us a try.
All right, well, Chef Gene Webb, thanks for your time today.
Oh, thank you so much.
Gene Webb is the owner and proprietor of North Shore Boulangerie in Shorewood. The business is participating in Bastille Days this year for the first time. You can find them on the northern border of the park.
We'll take one more break, and then it's time for our storytelling series, Expabula. Lake Effect Weekend continues in a moment on 89.7 WUWN.
Two, one.
Welcome to Expabula!
True personal story.
Expabula!
Expabula is a Milwaukee nonprofit committed to strengthening community bonds through the art of storytelling.
And it's another edition of Expabula Radio on Lake Effect Weekend. And we welcome back the co-founder of Expabula, Leah Delaney. Hello.
Bonjour, bonjour.
Bonjour. That's about the extent of my French, but so great to have you here. And it is hot and humid out there. We kind of like this time of the year, actually.
Yep.
Great week to be talking about water.
Yes, everybody's drawn to it. In fact, I wish I was at the Noah's Ark Water Park as we speak, but alas, I am not. But yes, water, water everywhere. That is our theme for this week's show. We actually had a water-themed story slam this past year at the Lakefront Brewery. And we're going to be showcasing, featuring a couple of those storytellers today. But the reason why we're talking about water today is that Reflow Sustainable Water Solutions, in collaboration with Expabula, developed this new app called Water Story Milwaukee. In fact, it's Water Story MKE. And what that is a digital water-themed scavenger hunt across Milwaukee. So they are busting out their Great Water Race, which is going to be held on July 22nd. There will be prizes. There'll be opportunities for you to tell your own stories relating to water. It's a fabulous app, and I honestly can't think of a better way to experience Milwaukee in different areas that you've never traversed through, through scavenger hunts, actually. There's a couple of them around Milwaukee, but this is another one, and it's going to prove to be be fabulous, I'm sure.
That is such a cool idea. Did you say underwater as well, or just along the waterways?
It's along the waterways, but I don't know. Maybe there will be some underwater action.
I hope so. That brings us to our first story, I believe.
Yes, ma'am. So we'll start our show off with Stuart Rudolph's water story. Here's Stuart.
My story about the incredible life-giving power of water starts on a beautiful spring Indiana day with my my good buddy, and I actually had my wife. We were young at the time, just gotten married myself, and my friend had his girlfriend of the week he was trying to impress. And we started out on this canoe trip, and I have to tell you that we were big adventurers. We had done a lot of crazy stuff between scuba diving and sailing across the Gulf Stream from Florida to the Bahamas, and we thought we knew water pretty well. We thought we were pretty safe around water. And so we had gone out and bought a couple canoes and said, hey, how hard can it be? Let's, you know, hey, we know on this map, we've driven by it, we can put in at this bridge and we can take out this other bridge. So, you know, should be fun, no big deal. So we're paddling down the river and we're having a good time. And, you know, what we do notice that the water is, well, it's moving really, really fast. It's like a spring flood. And we're having to paddle pretty hard just to maintain some steerage in the current. And, you know, as we're going along, and the water is also very cold. When, you know, we did have life jackets because we're not idiots. And then all of a sudden we started hearing this noise. It's like, what is that sound? It's like this roaring sound, and it's getting louder and louder. And we go around the corner in the river, and I'm thinking, well, what's going on? I don't see anything. And maybe there's a side stream or something. Maybe there's a waterfall coming in off a side stream. And we go around another corner in the river, and there it is. There's a dam all the way across the river right next to a big power plant. And it's like, whew, I didn't expect that. I didn't know that was here. And so my buddy, he's paddling really hard with his new girlfriend in the back, and he just decides to go for it because he's a little bit more gung-ho than I. So he goes for it, and he goes right over this six-foot dam. Boom! And into the water right away. And, you know, in the water, we found out the hard way, was really, really cold. And so I looked at that, and I'm thinking, there's got to be a better way. So my wife and I'm saying, Alice, come on, back up. So we're paddling as hard as we can to go backwards and go and get away. And oh, and there's this big red sign over there that says Portage. I guess we were supposed to have gone for that, known about that in advance. But at any rate, so we're trying to paddle really hard to get over to the Portage sign, and not doing too well. And by then, the canoe has turned sideways to the top of the dam, and then we roll right over it. And the next thing I remember is I'm spit out in this freezing cold, churning water, and I'm screaming for my wife, saying, Alice, where? I can't see her. I can't see what's going on. I kind of vaguely see some fishermen off to the side on the side of the bank, and I eventually get up, I look around on the bank, I see my buddy and his girlfriend, and the canoes are way downstream, but there's no Alice. I'm looking around, well, where's Alice? I'm really getting panicky at this point. And then finally, there's some fishermen say, hi, there's somebody over there, and they go over and they find her. She's floating face down in the water. And I am just speechless at this point. I don't know what to say. I can't scream loud enough anymore. They go and get her and pull her up. And by the time I get down to that spot, I see that she's just coughing up water. And you know, thank God she's alive. And we rush off to the hospital where the doctors say one of her lungs is completely full of water, but they managed to get her to recover, and you know, we walked out of there later that afternoon and went back down to the bridge where we left our other car. And I learned a lot from that. Water can give life, but it can also take it away just like that. You got to be really careful and know what you're doing and read the manual. If there's something about the river and it says, hey, there's a portage,
probably should take that into account. Yep. Thank you very much.
And that was Stuart Rudolph, who told his water story at our Water Story Slam at the Lakefront Brewery in February.
Read the manual. I love that advice. Very practical when you get down to it.
Yeah, I wish I subscribed to that more often. It'd probably save me, I don't know, hours of my life at this point. So let's roll right into the next story. This was again told at our water. So let's roll right into our next story. This was again told at our water-themed story slam at the Lakefront Brewery in February. Here's Amy Jensen.
So I have to start by saying that I work for the Water Council, but that's not what my story's about. When I was 8 or 9, I went fishing with my dad. Now, the two things that you need to know about my dad for this story are, first, he lived in the shadow of the great fisherman, his father-in-law, where my mother would tell these stories of the great fisherman. He owned Pewaukee Lake. He caught muskie. The other thing you need to know about my dad is he never got into a body of water full on, full out, without first gently tapping the water, testing it to his skin, touching all over his body to get the temperature just properly acclimated to his body, and then he would get in the water. So this fine, beautiful summer day, I decided to go with him to go fishing, because he'd been spending his time going down to Clody Beach and spending some time on his own fishing, so I tagged along. And so we were all set up. He was in his waders. He was fishing away, and darned if he did not land a really nice lake trout. I don't know, probably like that. So he set it up on the stringer, and he tied the stringer to his belt loop, and he went on fishing. Now, for an 8 or 9 year old who isn't actually fishing at all and looking around, and yeah, it's a nice day, but it got kind of boring. So I reached up and grabbed his shirt, and I said, "Dad, could I hold the fish?" So he untied the stringer, handed it over to me. So I was standing there holding the stringer, and the fish was swimming around, but the fish was still alive, and he was a strong fish. So the next thing I knew, pew, off it was swimming, away. And I thought, uh-oh. And I reached up and pulled on my dad's shirt again, and I said, "Dad, there goes the fish." There was not a hesitation, not the flash portion of a second. And this man who always had to get used to the water, pew, in the water, arms flailing. And I'm on the shore watching this. And I hear the laughter of the fishermen also along the shore, seeing all this unfold. My dad had always been a gentleman, so at least I had that going for me, but I wasn't exactly sure what fate awaited me when he emerged from the water. But he emerged from the water with the fish that he had caught a second time. He told me later that he could see the little gold end of the stringer out in front, and he was just bound and determined to catch it. So he stood up, soaking wet. Of course, he tied the fish back onto his own belt loop, not to be allowed in my hands again. And he stood, he fished for a little while longer, and then it was time for us to go home. And he finally looked down at me, and all he said was, "Your mother would never have believed me if I hadn't caught that thing again." And that was our day.
And that was Amy Jensen telling us her water story.
You know, I love to be out on the water, Leah, but I don't know anything about fishing. So anytime I hear a story like this, I'm in such admiration of what they can do.
Yeah, yeah, most definitely.
Or what the daughters can do, or maybe do by accident. So. Yeah.
Truly. So just to wrap up, the reason why we're talking about water today and fishing and all of that good stuff is because ReFlow Sustainable Water Solutions is jumping off with their Water Story MKE app. And they have a great water race, which is going to be an awesome scavenger hunt. And it's going to be held on July 22nd. So if you want more information about that, you can either go to ReFlow's Sustainable Waters website. You can go to exfabula.org to find out that and everything else story related. Or you can go on Facebook. I know that they have a Facebook event out for the scavenger hunt called the Great Water Race.
That sounds so cool. Yeah. And I hope they wave to us because the Chase Tower where we're located is right along the Milwaukee River. So give us a wave when you go by. Well, more great stories. Thank you so much, Leah, for joining us again this weekend.
Thank you, Rachel. It's good to see you.
Fabula is a regular feature on Lake Effect Weekend, and it wraps up the show today. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Tyke. Thanks so much for making us a part of your weekend. Lake Effect Weekend airs every Saturday and Sunday from 3 to 4 on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM Milwaukee Public Radio, NPR in Milwaukee.
Stay tuned for Weekend All Things Considered coming up next. It's 4 o'clock.